Although this story is far from over, the majority of what I'll share occurred about 12 years ago. It's around 2009 and I'm still living with my folks. We've moved into the neighborhood when I was 13. Not long after I discovered the woods across the road, I was sort of forced into making the woods my sanctuary because of the bullying I experienced and all the turmoil at home. This neighborhood didn't have many kids living in it, and the few there were older, among other things. All the hostility made me a very nervous kid. Any free time I had was spent alone. I got curious one day and wandered into the woods. There didn't appear to be anyone but me out there, and this gave me a strange feeling of safety, something I'd not felt for a long time. I found this small circle of cedar trees that made a secret open area and made it my clubhouse of sorts. As time passed, I began spending more and more time in the trees. I even accidentally fell asleep and spent the night out there once, and I was sure my parents were going to freak out, but they hadn't even noticed. This was the only excuse I needed. I began camping in my clubhouse every once in a while at first. I wasn't missed a single time. I knew I was going to need some camping supplies now, though. I tried bringing things from home, but they wore out fast. Asking my parents for money was out of the question. I began going door to door and offering my services as a lawnmower. I'd never mowed a lawn in my life, but that wasn't important. The real problem was finding a lawnmower. I would sneak my dad's mower out and do a job, but eventually I was caught and actually caught a beating for it. Fortunately, I had enough money by then to buy a really terrible end one of my own. It took all the money I'd saved, but it was a much safer way to make it. Once I managed to remake the money I'd lost, I hopped on my barely working bike and rode it to the 5 miles to this dinky army surplus place. I emerged with an Alice pack stuffed with various things that I thought I needed. I was so excited to try the stuff out. I skipped a whole week of school and camped out in my clubhouse. It was an addictive hobby, but something much more for me. It was the only source of safety and happiness I had. For the next however many years, I went to school just enough not to cause any trouble. I would go straight from school to my clubhouse every afternoon. By now, I'd come to see those woods as mine. Anybody in between would have been seen as an invader in my mind, and when that day came, I didn't think twice about striking back. It was a Sunday afternoon. I'd been camping out all weekend and was taking the well-worn path to the creek to get water. Across the creek, about 50 yards, was an almost deserted road. I rarely saw anyone use it. I caught sight of a parked camper. The two men walking in and out of it never seemed to notice me, and when I returned a few hours later, they were still there. Only now they were drinking beers and mindlessly shooting guns. This made me furious, but when a stray bullet actually struck the water just feet from me, I had had enough. I ran the mile back home and called the sheriff. I assumed my call was anonymous, but now I'm not so sure. I made up a story that I had gotten lost and drove up on the men. I lied and said they had threatened me with their guns. And I realize how wrong that is now, but I was young and angry. One morning as I prepared for school, I overheard a news report about a big meth lab bust. Acting on an anonymous tip, sheriff's deputies found two men shooting guns on a country road. Upon further investigation, the camper the men were driving turned out to be a mobile meth lab. The two men were taken into custody and were being held pending bail hearings, and I knew this had to have been the call I made. The seriousness of the situation scared me, but I was confident no one would know that it was me that had made the call. And for the next year, I even followed the case. About 3 months before their sentencing hearing, I received an unnamed letter in the mail, and it simply said, "You mess with the wrong people, kid." A jolt of ice-cold fear shot through me, but I still doubted it was from the two men. Any doubt I had was removed when another came the next week, this one far clearer. "You better pray we get time served." I was too terrified at the time to wonder how they knew that it was me. I'm still not sure how they identified me, but the how no longer mattered. The letters continued to arrive. When the day of the hearing came, the news was not good. Both men were felons found with multiple firearms. Adding on the manufacturing charge and you get a minimum of 10 years. The judge was not feeling generous. He gave both of the men 20 years. I was sure my days on Earth were numbered. I stopped going to school and spent all my time in the woods. I wasn't foolish enough to think that it would keep me safe, but if I was going to die, I wanted to die somewhere I loved. A strange thing happened, though. The death I was expecting never came. Month after month, I became more confident that it all had been a joke or more than likely just an intimidation tactic. My life flew by, and this last 10 years has been a series of ups and downs. The meth heads have been the last thing on my mind. Then, last week, a new anonymous letter showed up at my apartment. You better write a will. The end is close at hand. I involuntarily dropped it, like a hot potato. My girlfriend was with me and witnessed it. She picked up the letter and read it, and I could tell she was concerned, but I played it off as a prank and refused to explain. And just like that, a ghost from my past reappeared into the present. You can probably guess what this unwanted news had done to me. I feel like I'm constantly looking over my shoulder everywhere I go. I'm terrified these monsters may go after my girlfriend and newborn child. Going to the cops was a brief consideration, but without any proof of who the sender is, I know there's not much they can do. My options seem to be limited. Without anyone else to talk to, I'm anonymously emailing this in to tell my story. I'm not sure why. It could be because of the anonymity of the internet. There's not much more I can say other than to tell you all to be careful of the choices you make as a child. Wish me luck and please pray for me and my family.
Did you enjoy the first story? If you did, I would love it if you would subscribe to the channel. Oh, if you want your broccoli to be served fresh, then don't forget to hit the bell icon. Keep munching.
This is an experience my wife and I just had this past year. As soon as the quarantine was lifted in our area, she and I filled our packs and went for a hike at our local state park. It was something we used to do pretty regularly and have since before we got married. Speaking for myself, I was really looking forward to it. The plan was to hike out to a certain lake, spend the night, and hike back to the car. It was a clear, warm day and the trails were nice and dry. For most of that morning, we had been the only people on the trail. We decided to stop for lunch at a campsite about halfway to the lake. Another couple must have had the same idea. They were sitting at the concrete picnic table and we asked to join them. Soon, the four of us were discussing what we had seen and where we were headed. The couple turned out to be newlyweds on their honeymoon. My wife, who's a hopeless romantic, loved to hear this. She proceeded to tell them how we'd met and some other sappy stuff I don't bother to remember. 2 hours passed and we finally said our goodbyes. We arrived at the lake about an hour before dark, tired and hungry. I got a fire started and Mandy, my wife, cooked us a small meal while I pitched the tent. We sat around the fire cooking s'mores and eventually called it a night at around 10 p.m. I got up just before dawn the next morning and got the fire ready to make the breakfast. We repeated our roles from the night prior, except I pulled the tent down and repacked it. All the measures were taken to ensure the fire was completely out after cooking, and with that, we took to the trail for the return journey. At 10 a.m., we reached the halfway point, but chose not to stop. 2 hours up the trail, we ran into the husband of the couple we'd met the day before. Strangely, his wife wasn't with him. Mandy asked him about her location, and the man said that she'd become ill the night before and return home. When he said it, he'd looked nervous and couldn't look either of us in the eyes. Before either of us could ask anything else, he said that his wife had insisted he finish the trip alone. It sounded a bit strange, but we had no reason not to believe him. A group of people came walking up about that same time, and the husband excused himself to talk to them. I wasn't interested in prying any further. Their marriage was none of my business, I thought. Mandy looked like she wanted to stay, but I reminded her of the obligations we had that night. She reluctantly agreed and we went on our way. We got to the parking lot not too long after and packed up our stuff. There were a few groups of people talking amongst themselves. As we pulled out of the lot, several more cars, including a Ranger's truck, were pulling in. Once again, I thought nothing of it. We made it back home that afternoon and handled some family things. It wasn't until breakfast that we heard the news. I had grabbed a cup of coffee and sat down in front of the TV. I flipped it on just in time to receive a report of a dead female camper. When they showed her face on the screen, I almost choked on my coffee. It was a picture of the woman we had met just 2 days prior. I yelled out to Mandy to join me in the living room. I wanted to be sure of what I was seeing. I didn't have my glasses on at the time, and I pointed at the TV and asked, "Isn't that one of the newlyweds we met at the park?" She watched for a moment and let out a shocked gasp. Just then, a wedding photo of the couple appeared on the screen. Mandy grabbed the remote from my hand and turned up the volume. According to the husband, the couple had been at a cliffside that was a popular lookout. Mandy and I had been there once or twice ourselves in the past. They had watched the sun rise, and as they were preparing to turn and leave, the wife lost her footing and fell several hundred feet to the ground below. It was certainly possible, but something bothered me about it. Why hadn't he mentioned this to us? More so, what was up with the illness story? It couldn't have been more than a few hours after the incident had occurred. None of his behavior made any sense. I know if something such as that happened to me, I'd have been a mess. We had passed at least 15 people that morning and not a soul talked to us. It all seemed fishy to me. I was glad to see that Mandy agreed with me. It looked as if though her instincts had been right once again. Just don't tell her I said that. After a long discussion about our responsibilities and the like, we agreed that we should contact the law enforcement involved in the case. And as it stood, the husband isn't under any suspicion. Not publicly, anyways. I contacted the sheriff's office and told them what we knew. The deputy put us on hold for a moment, and when he returned, he said someone may reach out to us in the future. But it's been almost a year, and no one has contacted us. And this is what brings me to emailing you here. What do you think? My instincts and my wife's tell us that a crime may have occurred. We, however, have no proof or any real justification for our feelings. And that's just what they are, feelings. Certainly if law enforcement believed we had something to offer, they would have already contacted us, right? I don't want to be a nuisance, nor do I want to cause trouble for a grieving man who, by all appearances, is a decent person. But help me out here. Should I keep pushing or leave the police to do their jobs? I just can't shake this nagging feeling that a man is getting away.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.
With cold-blooded murder.